Make way. It was a balmy afternoon in late October in 1982 when Badger Stadium in Wisconsin was packed to overflowing with avid football fans. More than 60,000 diehard Wisconsin Badger fans had gathered to see their beloved team take on the Michigan State Wolverines. Within a matter of moments, it was clear that the Wolverines were the better team, for they took control of every aspect of that game. What was odd, however, as the score became more and more lopsided, was the sudden and repeated burst of applause and shouts of joy from the Wisconsin fans. Even though their team was getting pummeled on the field by the Wolverines, they were smiling and they were high-fiving each other as if they were winning rather than losing. It made absolutely no sense to any reasonable observer. What in the world was going on in that stadium? Well, it turns out that 70 miles away, the Milwaukee Brewers baseball team were beating the St. Louis Cardinals in Game 3 of the 82 World Series. And many of the fans in the football stadium were also listening to the baseball game on portable radios. And they were responding to events on the radio rather than what was going on in the field right in front of them. To someone who didn't know the whole story, such a scene would be confusing and might lead one to wonder about the sanity of the Badger fans. Perhaps I've read the story of Jesus' triumphal entry too many times, but I get a sense that to the uninitiated, this scene that's played out on the road going in Jerusalem is confusing. This is especially true in light of what will happen in just a few days at the place of the skull, or as we also call it, Golgotha. What's going on here? Why is everyone so excited and so ready to condemn in just a few days? Like many of you, I know the elements of the story and most of the major players in it, but as I reflect on that joyous, palm-strewing crowd that greeted Jesus that day, I wonder, are they seeing the same thing that I'm seeing? What exactly are they cheering about? I'm not the only one wondering. What all this fuss is about, they wondered. Because Matthew tells us that the entire city of Jerusalem was stirred up and they asked, "Who is this?" No one save Jesus himself saw the whole picture of what was going on. As appreciated and as truthful as the celebratory shouts of the crowd were, they would ring hollow in just a few days. That joyous cacophony flowing out along the road going into Jerusalem actually hid the real story. In the crowd of people that day, there were sinister plans afoot. The religious leaders, fearing their own lack of control and their own lack of prominence, wanted that parade stopped. They were not praising God as Jesus rode on a donkey into Jerusalem. The religious leaders knew full well and better than most folks the prophecy of Isaiah 62 verse 11. Tell the people of Israel, look, your king is coming to you. He's humble, riding on a donkey, even a donkey's colt. Jesus was clearly making a provocative statement. Jesus was calling on those aware enough of the symbolism to make a decision. This whole scene on the road is Jesus' declaration that he is the Messiah. Jesus' entire ministry, all that we know and much that we don't know about, comes down to this point on the road. Every healing, resurrection, deliverance from demons, all that teaching are consistent with the scene of Jesus riding in on a donkey. You can pretend any way you want that this is just a coincidence. or that Jesus never really intended himself to be seen as Messiah, but the scriptures don't let you explain it away. Jesus is declaring here that he is the Messiah. There's no other conclusion you can make from this. Consider, if you will, the significance of this triumphal entry that all four Gospels record it. All four Gospels call on us to look past the pageantry to the message. All four Gospels ask us to stop our shouting along the road for a moment, stop our palm waving, and ask ourselves a question. Who is this? Who is this who makes the lame to walk, the blind to see, the dead to live? Who is this whose teaching strikes at the very heart of our being? Who is this who dares to ride a colt in clear fulfillment of the prophecy and declares he is the one, he's the chosen Messiah? The religious leaders took offense to what was unfolding right before them. They accused Jesus of blasphemy, of overstepping his rightful place. Do you remember how they used to like to remind people that he's just the simple son of a carpenter, a man of illegitimate birth? They saw Jesus as bold and brash. They saw him as arrogant. Wait a minute. Let's think about that word arrogance for a moment. The dictionary defines it as being haughty, of having too high an opinion of oneself. Most of us don't appreciate anyone who's arrogant. We really don't. All through our lives, we meet people who consider themselves to be better than we are. The religious authorities believed Jesus was arrogant because he assumed an authority they wouldn't grant him. Now, the funny thing about arrogance is you can only be arrogant if the opinion you have of yourself is wrong. Think about that. If I claim to be the very best bass fisherman in the world, I'm only arrogant if the claim is proven false, right? Jesus claiming to be one with the Father, of being the Messiah, is only arrogant if it's not true. I think that the issue before us today isn't the truth about Jesus, but rather the religious authorities, and more importantly, our own unwillingness to accept the truth. They had all the proof any of us could ever want to prove the validity of Jesus' words, and they still continued to refuse to believe. They didn't want to admit that they were wrong and the crowds are right. The unwashed, uneducated masses saw the hand of God at work in Jesus, and the privileged, educated scholars failed to see it or believe it. It's just like that football game in Wisconsin. The religious leaders, they're listening to something else. What were they listening to? Well, they were listening to their traditions. They were listening to their grip on power. They were listening to their perceived authority, and it caused a complete disconnect to what was happening on that road to Jerusalem. In their zeal to protect their externalized spirituality, they missed the significance of the most important message Jesus sought to impart to everyone. When Jesus rode into Jerusalem on a donkey, when he cleared the temple or cleansed the temple, when he refused to silence the children who sang his praises, he was being intentionally confrontational to the religious authorities. I believe wholeheartedly that Jesus was casting a bright light onto the failure of externalized spirituality. Philip Yancey, in several of his writings, likes to talk about what it was like for him to go to Bible college. Even though he is being truthful, at least from his perspective, he's hardly flattering to the college that he attended. Here's just a snippet of one of his experiences. A friend of mine got called to the dean's office for wearing a coat hemmed higher than her regulation length skirt. "Joyce," the dean said, "what are we going to do with you?" "She was reprimanded as if she had broken one of the Ten Commandments," Yancey says. "Another time she wore a robe down the hall of the woman's dorm with the bottom button undone. The dean shook her head. "Joyce, how can we trust you? If you fail in a thing like this, how can God use you?" Later, that same student was working in the dean of woman's office on near when Valentine's Day came. She witnessed the bizarre scene of her dean, the boss, in white gloves, I kid you not, censoring one by one the tiny little candy-shaped hearts that are used as decorations for parties. "You're mine. Forever friends, be my Valentine." Those all passed muster, but cutie pie, hot lips, love ya, went right in the trash can. The religious leaders in Jesus' day were really good at making rules. They were really good at enforcing those same rules on themselves and on others. However, they fell into a dangerous trap. They began to see their reliance on the rules as the only way to gain God's approval. Furthermore, their reliance on those rules distracted them from more important matters like justice and mercy. Jesus used some of the most vivid and harshest words he ever uttered to challenge that externalized spirituality. And Jesus rode into Jerusalem on a colt demonstrating that Christ was willing to embrace humility. Into that clamoring sea of humanity, many of those who were there probably never saw the significance of that ride. But the truth is there. Perhaps Jesus broke the Pharisees' rules of decorum. Their rules about contact with the unwashed masses, but he demonstrated a higher purpose. The Son of Man came to seek and save that which was lost. You see, the facade, the spirituality of the religious leaders promoted was like a facade. It was a whitewashed tomb. True followers of God ride, walk, drive, fly into the messiness of life regardless of the cost. I'm sure no one here will doubt, but that little ride of Jesus cost him. The crowds, they shouted, they waved palm branches, they threw their coats on the road because there was a fresh wind blowing. Someone who claimed to be sent by God was not only willing, but went out of his way to reach people. Not just the respected, rule-following people, but even the worst of the worst, tax collectors and prostitutes and the sick. No wonder they praised him. How long had they waited for some hope, some sense that God cared for them? Comparing their lives to the high standards promoted by the religious elite, the vast majority despaired. I can never live up to keeping all those rules. Faced with the daunting goal of confronting such a high level of rule keeping, a lot of people, they just simply gave up trying. And they began to lead a double life. Their spirituality became a matter of conscience. Appear spiritual, at least publicly, but do whatever you want as long as no one sees you and no one catches you. You see, following Christ is not about giving the appearance of a spiritual life, regardless of how long your rule book is. Following Christ means having your heart changed, not your rule book. If our hearts are not redeemed, then we are nothing but whitewashed tombs. We have cleaned the outside of our bowls, but we have left the inside untouched. And the implications of an externalized faith, they're staggering. Again, Philip Yancey tells of an Iranian Muslim intellectual who was visiting a Harvard professor, and he made the following observation. This is a Muslim scholar, but remember. These young people, he says, may be lost to Islam forever. They follow the conventions of Islamic dress and custom because they were required to do so by law, but inside their hearts are hollow and cynical. We are losing an entire generation of unbelievers in our zeal to force conformity. That was a Muslim cleric. These words about Islam could be said about a whole generation of young people raised in the Christian church. In Jesus' day, there was a whole generation of people in danger of being lost to God because their hearts were hollow and they were cynical. People who were tired of the hypocrisy. They were tired of the burdensome rules from those who were entrusted to shepherd them. If there's no hope in ever connecting with God, either in this life or the next, why bother to have hope? If it is God's will that I be poor, blind, lame, forced into immoral lifestyle, why should I want to seek Him out? You wouldn't. But the good news is that God came and sought you out. The lost have been found. The poor have been made rich. The blind can see. The lame can walk. The dead come back to life. I was surprised to learn something this past week about the city of Memphis, Tennessee. Most of the time, like many of you, whenever I hear the name Memphis, I immediately think of what? Elvis Presley's Graceland Museum or mansion. What I was pleased to learn is that in Memphis, there's a very special museum dedicated to the civil rights movement in the United States. The museum is actually constructed around the motel where Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. And inside that museum are films and pictures of that violent time in the United States, and especially the violent police actions against protesters. One of the displays in that museum is the charred Greyhound bus that was burned to a crisp by an angry Alabama mob. The angry mob was intent on chasing away the Freedom Riders, those who were seeking to integrate transportation. As the bus burned on the highway, the angry mob actually held the doors closed, hoping to incinerate the young people that were inside it. Thankfully, with some hope from a highway patrolman, they were freed in time from that burning bus. The Freedom Riders and many others sought justice. They wanted the right to eat and sleep and ride wherever they wished. Martin Luther King Jr., on the day he was killed, gave his final speech entitled, "I've Been to the Mountaintop." He said in part, "I may not get there with you, but I want you to know that we as a people will get to the promised land." I like to think that Jesus' ride in Jerusalem was the ultimate freedom ride. A ride to call out people out of darkness and into the light of hope. And just as the Freedom Riders encountered resistance and hostility and violence, the cause of Christ will also face these things. And Christ did on his way to Jerusalem. So here we are, you and I again, same time each year, hearing the familiar stories, launching into Holy Week. What does it mean for us personally? Can we see the truth in Jesus' ride for our freedom? And more importantly, are we able to answer definitively that we know the answer to the world's most prevailing question? Who is this? Is it Jesus, the Son of God, our Lord and King? That's who I think it is. So come, join the chorus that resounds from the road in Jerusalem. Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.